Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's show is being brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, believers in good food for all. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45 from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Nastasia the Hammer Lopez is going to be here today, but she's not here yet because our favorite, the L train, is, of course, effed up today. Right, Dave?
That's what I hear. Yeah. Usually, I have less problems with that than the Q, though.
Yeah?
You're always.
Do you have to take the L a lot? Or
I
no?
do, every day.
So, usually the Q is your problem?
Yeah. I have to take the Q. I have a stupid commute. I have to go into Manhattan and then back over to Brooklyn via the L.
That is big dumb. Can't you just take that train of all train, the G's, that goes around in Brooklyn all the time, everywhere?
That would just be an insane... No, that would take too much time.
I think you can tell by his voice that we have Dave in the booth. How you doing, Dave?
I'm doing good, other than the mass transit problems.
Yeah? How's your week been?
Oh, it's good.
Yeah, I had
just kind of getting started, actually.
Really? I had a rather eventful week, but I'm not going to talk about it until Nastasia gets here so that we can, have a little...
I don't rate?
Well, no, I mean, I thought all three of us maybe could have the conversation, because I was in China, I was in Manila, doing the stuff. So I'll wait for her to get back to talk about that.
Fair enough.
In the meantime, you can call your questions in to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. So big news in big bad news. So the Harvey Weinstein scandal has, as you know, Dave, spread and into the food world recently. John Besh, from the Besh Restaurant Group, most prominently in New Orleans, had to step down.
I did not hear this, actually.
Yeah, a couple days ago, allegations of, I didn't actually get a chance to read, exactly what the allegations were, but basically improper sexual contact / harassment / perhaps assault. So he stepped down, and I think it's the first, kind of big name chef that we've heard this happen to. And one of the things I read is that, the person who's heading up the group now that he stepped down is going to all the staff, which, you should. And she's saying, please always feel free to step forward. Please feel comfortable to, say something if something happens to you. If you see something, please feel comfortable doing so. My message to, anyone out there who's a professional is don't wait for this kind of thing to happen in your restaurant or your bar or your restaurant group. Go out there and now, at your next staff meeting, take the time, when we start our bar, this is going to be a big part of our staff training. Go out there now and let everybody know that that everyone in your restaurant and bar finds this sort of behavior unacceptable. Let them know that, that they are going to be taken seriously and treated with respect if they come forward, and just make that a part of your culture and do it now before it's too late and you haven't done it, right? I mean, that makes sense, right, Dave?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's also just, the right thing to do.
Yeah. And Nastasia the Hammer Lopez is now here. We're talking about John Besh.
I did not hear or read. Yeah. I heard a little bit.
All right, well, we'll talk about it later since we already talked about it on
John
air.
John Tesh, too, right?
John Tesh, too. Wow.
For real?
No, spreading rumors, sorry.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's a different industry. But, look, one of the primary things, at least in the bar and restaurant industry, is a lot of people hide behind hide behind alcohol. I think that's one of the big issues, right?
You mean they blame it on alcoholism?
Oh no, not alcoholism, but they didn't mean it. They were drunk.
Right, right. Blah, it doesn't count.
No, yeah, right. Yeah. And that's just not accurate. Yeah. Incorrect. You know, alcohol is not an excuse, when you hit someone with a car because you chose to get drunk, and alcohol is certainly not an excuse for sexual assault under any circumstances whatsoever. Anyway, enough of that for today. How you doing, Nastasia?
Yeah. Oh, train.
Oh yeah, we mentioned to the
so bad. I don't want to take it anymore.
What happened? I never have problems with the L.
Crawling. Well, but do you come from the other direction?
I come from Manhattan.
Oh, well, it crawled through the Bedford, from Manhattan to Brooklyn.
And
that's like a 7-minute.
I'm assuming most of you have not traveled on the subway with Nastasia, but she believes that the Metropolitan Transit Authority, who are the people that run the subway, she believes that they purposely stay too long at the platform just to mess with her. She thinks that they can speed off somehow, like at three times the rate, and don't do it literally just to piss her off. Would you say that's...
No, I think that if there is a delay, you should stop the train. Don't crawl. Crawling makes it...
Crawling is infuriating.
Have you been in a stopped subway with Booker?
He'd rather it crawl.
If it's going, it's going. If it's stopped, he's like, "Why is it stopped? Mm. Why is it stopped? Is it ever going to start again? Ever? Is
or,
it ever going to?"
It's crawling and honking. Ugh.
Well, the honking
that was today.
It's honking because there are literally people in the tracks that are working on the freaking tracks,
and there's people moving, getting place to place on the subway.
Yeah, but they have to. They go. Bah, 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 and those people get into the little side divots. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. No, I know. But why can't they work at 3 a.m., 4 a.m.?
I mean, presumably they are working at both times. I mean,
they all had sandwiches as we passed them slowly.
So you're saying Peter Kim? You're saying
is now working for the MTA.
Peter Kim's working for Peter Kim. Cooking Issue's favorite punching bag, well known for his nervous reaction to anything is to eat sandwiches. I think he has in his pockets at all times, he has some form of sandwich. Perhaps.
That's a nervous reaction?
Yeah.
He was, yeah. At any point, if he sees a sandwich, he'll pick it up, like a moldy egg salad sandwich, as we, as we've said about
like
the
before
show.
Before every gala, MOFED gala,
when sandwiches.
We're like unloading, we're like, Peter, why are you eating a sandwich?
And even if he's just finished a sandwich, there's always that little bit of sandwich in the corner of his mouth. Like, you just had a sandwich.
Yeah, don't.
Right? Every time, Nastasia and I, okay, so the thing with Nastasia and I is that we're not good examples. For instance, when you're filming or whatever, everyone's like, oh, we need to break for lunch because they do it for the crew and all this stuff. Everyone breaks for lunch. Everyone has lunch. I'm like, no, just freaking work until it's done.
Finished.
Just freaking work until it's over and
finished.
Either we'll die or we'll eat eventually, right? I mean, it's... I actually don't get hungry when I'm working. When you're actually working hard, do you get really hungry, Nastasia?
No.
I will realize at the end of a day here that I haven't eaten.
Right. Let's take this as a note. If you are getting very hungry while you're working, unless you have actually starved yourself for like a whole day, you're probably a little bit bored, right? I mean, like, I get hungry either when I'm sitting or talking or thinking about food a lot. But when you're cooking food, you're not thinking about food.
Eventually, your stomach eats itself, and then you're good.
Are you one of those people? So, Nastasia, are you one of those people? My wife, Jen, is like this. Who at certain no, my wife's not an angry person.
No, like when you don't eat, she gets
angry. Well, no, she's very thin. She gets hypoglycemic, whatever. Mm-hmm. But my point is that she gets to the point where she's like, I'm not hungry anymore.
Yes, yeah.
You know, so if you're waiting to go to, you go to some place and they're like, it's an hour wait, and you're like, oh, we'll go somewhere else, and the next place is like, it's a 2-hour wait, and then you go back to the first place, and it's an hour. I'm not hungry anymore.
Yes.
I've had that happen. Well, is there like a biological reason for that? I mean, obviously your stomach isn't really shrinking, is it?
I don't know. It doesn't ever happen to me. You know, I could always either eat or not eat. You know, it's never, I'm never at the point where
I could eat.
I could eat. I could eat.
It's really weird. This man is wearing a diamond engagement ring on his hand.
Why is that weird? Because he's a guy?
You never see a man with a diamond.
Is it on his engagement ring?
Yes.
Don't gender norm that, bro.
Wow.
Looks like he's traditional.
Nastasia's going to continue to stereotype until somebody calls in.
Unless that's a woman. Is that a woman?
I don't know. I have no idea. But listen, I was just in, as I was saying, I didn't want to talk about it until I got back. I was in China. I was in
China.
In the Philippines. And you were at the farm, right?
No, I didn't go.
Oh, you didn't go? I thought you said you went to the farm. Mm-hmm.
No, I said it was Saturday.
Oh, well, we missed the event we go to typically every year at Cesare Casella's farm, Discovery Farm. Well, next year maybe if they invite us, we'll talk about it. Did they not invite us?
No, they did. We were just both not.
What do you do at Cesare's farm? Pick prosciutto off the trees?
Yeah. Oh, my God. Can you imagine? Like, imagine if there was a Willy Wonka with cured meats.
That is what Cesare is.
Yeah, Cesare is the Willy Wonka of cured meats.
He really kind of is. Mm-hmm. I'm going to buy him a purple hat. The old, you know, we're going to do the old Willy Wonka.
He would wear it too.
Right? Yeah, he would totally wear that.
What's the grossest part of Willy Wonka?
The original Willy Wonka?
Yeah.
What's the the chicken head getting cut off?
No.
What?
When they're in the tunnel. In one bed.
No, that's not the grossest,
grossest part.
Because they pee and poop in the bed because he hasn't gotten out of his bed in 20 years.
Yeah.
That one?
Yeah.
I don't know, man.
Nasty scene.
I think that I don't like the tunnel scene. What about you, Dave? See, Nastasia reads too much into it.
There's just too many. That movie is just profoundly disturbing in so many ways.
Really? Because my whole kind of life is based on it. I love that movie.
Yeah, no.
Too disturbing for you?
Like, what do you find disturbing about it? The children getting mangled?
No, that's good. That's okay. I don't know. Just something about the tone of that movie never really rubbed me the right way.
Is it the weird asides that Gene Wilder makes during the entire film?
Yeah, probably.
Now I have all those weird asides going through my head.
My Catholic upbringing, you know.
Yeah. There's a little bit of a racist knock on gypsies in that, Tinker. Anyway, we're not talking about Willy Wonka today. Got too much to talk about.
We do have a caller, actually.
Oh, really? All right, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Sean calling from England.
Hey, how you doing? How's England?
Yeah, it's good, thanks.
Good.
So a while ago, I had a really delicious rhubarb granita at a restaurant. It had a nice pale pink color and sort of clean taste of rhubarb, and it dissolved, melted nicely in my mouth. And I'm wondering if you have any advice on replicating that experience at home.
Well, have you tried it and it's been a bad experience?
Well, I made a sort of sorbet-ish thing with stewed rhubarb, but, you know, I had a bit too much sort of fibrous material.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the cooked taste wasn't really what I was looking for.
Well, okay, so raw rhubarb has a very particular flavor. And you either like it or you don't, because it retains... it's oxalic acid crystal. So it has a very particular flavor and kind of astringency and a little bit of a vegetal nature that gets kind of knocked off by cooking. So you could try juicing. If you have a juicer, you could juice raw rhubarb, which I've done. I've juiced and clarified rhubarb before for drinks. But I found that... You remember when we used to do that, Stas? We juiced it. You never had that? Nils and I used to do that. And most people, I think, like it a little bit cooked. So I think rhubarb is also one of those things like ginger where the taste change is rather dramatic from raw to cooked. And so as with ginger, I haven't done a lot of experimentation, but as with ginger, you know, you might be able to get to some in-between medium that's really good between the cooked and the raw. As for the fibrousness, obviously, it's extremely fibrous. So you could, like I say, juice it, in which case most of the fiber will end up in the, in the pulp that comes out of the juicer. Or you could strain the product through a chinois. But bear in mind, you'll lose a lot, especially if it's cooked and you activate the pectin. You'll lose an awful lot of product if you put it through a chinois. If you had a spins all, you could clarify. Once you clarify it, then you have like a clear juice. Then you could add some pulp back if you want more body to make a granita or whatnot. The other choice you could do to bulk up the liquids about it a little bit is to dope it in with some other juice as well. So if you did rhubarb and then, you know, the classic, obviously, like trite thing would be strawberry, but, you know, it happens to work. They meld rather well. And for instance, you could probably get away with some raw rhubarb flavor if you had something to round out that kind of sharp oxalic note, something like a strawberry with a little bit of sugar. And that'll allow you to cut the fiber down, because you definitely, in a melting sorbet, don't want those long, thin fibers. Now, if you have a VitaPrep, you can blend the ever-loving snot out of those fibers, and you can probably get most of those fibers chopped into indistinguishable paste. However, it'll be quite thick, in which case, again, you're going to want to thin it out with some juice, and, you know, the juice of your choice, like, you know, whatever, strawberry juice, orange juice, you know, whatever. Orange, probably not. Strawberry, something with more of a red feel. What do you think, Nastassia? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, is this any of this helpful at all?
It's rhubarb.
What do you say?
What was that, Dave?
This line from the Batman movie with Jack Nicholson.
He talks about rhubarb?
He says, never rub another man's rhubarb. I'm still not sure what that means.
I would hope that his rhubarb is not shaped like rhubarb. That would be quite weird.
Never rub another man's rhubarb.
Wow, that's very strange.
That movie is full of jokes that as like a six-year-old I just did not get.
Yeah, but also it's kind of late. Do you guys still have rhubarb over there in England?
Well, no, I was just looking to do it when it comes in season.
All right, well, you know what? You know who loves rhubarb a lot is my son Dax. You know what? This sounds like a good application for the Paco Jet. I mean, I know most people don't have a Paco Jet, but a Paco Jet is going to beat the ever-loving snot out of that rhubarb as well. Probably just make a base and then throw the rhubarb chunks into it and just Paco Jet it, and it'll probably come out okay. But listen, anyone in the chat room do any raw rhubarb sorbet stuff? Dave?
So far, no.
I'll put it out there and we'll see what happens. Yeah, chat room. Hook us up, chat room. Hit me up on cooking issues, and if anyone sends me some stuff, I'll like it or whatever, and then we can come back and talk about it next week.
There is one quick question from the chat room. They want to know if you're going to sell low-quality individual shirts on Amazon ever.
Why?
Well,
they're already.
You can literally buy one right now. Nastassia, tell them how to get one.
Shopify.bookerandax.com. Something like
Shopify,
that.
Shopify. Booker and Dax. Google that.
Okay, if you go to bookerandax.com, for some reason, on the upper right-hand corner, it just says LQI, because we are low-quality individuals.
Yes.
And you click, if you go to bookerandax.com and you click LQI, which, why would you know that stands for low-quality individual? Why would you know? Now
but
you
if
do.
They Googled low-quality individual t-shirt Booker and Dax.
Well, why are you making them Google the stuff? You just tell them our URL, bookerandax.com. They go to it. They click the thing that says LQI.
Feel like you get to it faster. Whatever. I mean, I thought these were smart listeners, but...
Wow. My favorite, though, I have to say, I really like the Star Wars Enemy Equality. You don't like the Enemy Equality?
I thought about it last night. No.
Why?
I wouldn't wear it. I don't know.
Why? Because to Star Wars?
Yeah.
Too manly?
Mm-hmm.
What the hell's manly about it?
I don't know. Just something masculine about it.
What the hell's masculine about it?
Maybe because it is Star Wars and you're like Star Wars geek man.
Star Wars geek man. What?
Star Wars geek. Mostly men.
You saying women don't like Star Wars?
I would say the majority. Is this another thing?
Are we taking a poll?
Yeah.
Women out there, do you like Star Wars?
I'm sure there's some.
England, are you still on the line?
Anyway.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan.
a guy.
Or a Trekkie.
I know.
Or Doctor Who.
Oh, come on. England, he has to like the Doctor Who. Are you one of those Doctor Who telephone booth fans?
Well, I watched it when I was a kid, but it's a bit cheesy for me.
Yeah, all right. That's fair. So when I was on the airplane back from China, the turbulence was so bad.
Ooh, I wasn't asking about
the
that.
Turbulence was so bad that I couldn't even operate my phone because my mind was erased. So I had to put on a movie that I knew by heart, and so I put on Star Wars 4, A New Hope. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had to put on a movie that...
Why didn't you just sit there with nothing?
What? Like sit there
I
in a
that.
Tube?
Sit there with your thoughts of death?
Sit there in
that.
A tube? Oh.
Where was it over?
It was an hour outside. So the interesting thing is, I don't know if you know this, this is not a cooking-related thing, so I'll try to keep it short, but the green line that is on that traces the path of your airplane is fake. It's not your actual path.
Why?
Shocker.
But I mean,
I'm shocked.
But why not? They know what your actual path is. They just draw some sort of line. It's like, you know, it's Harold in the green crayon. They just draw a random line between the two points. Because when... So right before
they don't know where they are. They
right before the turbulence, you know, I'm flying up and the line goes directly over North Korea. Like directly over North Korea.
You're like,
and I'm like, what? I'm like, what? Why would we? They're threatening to shoot down airplanes why would we go over? Yeah, why? I was like, what? What? You know what I mean?
Did and you then, ask somebody? Like, what?
Who am I going to ask?
The steward?
I'm like, you know what? Of course. And then, you know, I have all these conspiracy theories in my head. You know, I'm like, what?
Oh, that's so nervous.
Yeah, they don't know where they are. They're busy dumping chemtrails.
And for some reason, they're not flying at the maximum altitude. Like, most of my flights that take off out of Hong Kong and go up, they're hovering, you know, around like 32,000, 34,000 feet.
So they're like trying to be targeted.
They're like right in the missile zone. You know, like the surface air missile guys in North Korea are like, I could totally hit that. I could totally hit that.
So how did you find out you weren't going over?
Oh, because like as we started getting closer, the line started moving over and over into the ocean, you know, over international waters. I'm like, oh, they just wanted me to have a freaking heart attack. And then right when the line moved over, and so I stopped worrying about that, like the plane just starts like, and like, you know, like the washing machine kind of, yeah, like where you're like back, yeah, and sloshing, yeah, around, like, yeah, like, like that one. And then I was like, gosh, man, because when you have 14 hours left in your flight, you know what I mean?
Oh God, you're like, no end in sight.
Yeah, you're like, how long can it last? You're like, you know, when the flight's only 5 hours, you're like, okay, 5 hour flight, I'm in it. Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah, I'm good. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. But like a 14 hour flight in a tube, you know that they're going to turn off the lights. You can't say anything. You're in a window seat in the very backity back of the airplane because you booked late. And, you know, so I put on Star Wars and it was like one of those 4D rides at Disney World. You know what I mean? Where like, and it was, you know, well, you don't because you don't like Star Wars. The beginning scene when Darth Vader breaks into the rebel ship. So I felt it.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, when C-3PO and R2-D2 were in that escape pod, like, I was like, yeah, I get it now. I get it.
Oh my God.
But that's my trick for crappy airplane rides. Just put on something that you just know by heart.
That's good.
It was early.
No, you know what? I decided that drinking doesn't actually help me in these situations because you try to drink, you know, it's early in the morning anyway. You try to drink to put yourself to sleep, but all you are is like buzz, dehydrated, mm-hmm, and tired and freaked, mm-hmm, out.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
So whatever. Like in the evening now, I'll have a drink or whatever because why not? But whatever.
No, morning is a little bit much.
So yeah, morning's a bit. Although, you know what? People believe when they go to the airport that there's no such thing as time anymore.
I don't believe
that. No, but people, if you go to the lounge in the morning, people, you know, have nose drips of Chardonnay at, you know, 9 in the morning. They're like, well, it's 9 at night where I'm flying to. Mm-hmm. So, you know what I mean? So it's...
Yeah.
The justifications are worse than the action itself.
Yeah, but I think a lot of it is just nervousness on the plane. I think people are drinking because they're nervous on the airplane, and and I used to try to do that, but I just don't think it helps. It doesn't help me anyway. It probably helps some people, but it doesn't help me.
I never fall. It's more for nerves. I don't fall asleep.
Yeah, only if I have an aisle seat, though, then I can make it to the bathroom.
No, but if you have an aisle seat, look, let me tell you something about aisle seats on a 14-hour flight. You
can't see anything.
Well, first of all, yeah, you can't look out the window.
What sort of see?
See if we're going down.
Oh, come on. You're going to know.
No, listen. Everyone who's afraid of flying knows that if you're at the window and you open the window and you see that you're flying over some messed up clouds, you're like, oh, it's just some messed up clouds. And you can look out in the distance and see what's going on. You're like, okay, it's okay.
Yeah. No, that doesn't help totally me because I like me. I still think, oh, there could be catastrophic engine failure because of that cloud.
No, come on. An engine, it could be like...
Or if you see the sparkly lights at night, you see like houses and it's turbulent, you're like, we're not going to fall into a house.
Well, probably not. You probably won't fall at all.
Right.
Yeah. But, Anastasia and I are window seat. But what I can't stand is the having to get up 8 billion times when you're in the aisle on a 14-hour flight. Because you know that that person who chose the window seat enjoys peeing more than they enjoy their own life. And so, you know, I'll hold it in. If I have a window seat, I'm going to go bladder of steel. I will use
That sounds like a nightmare.
I'll use my Qigong skills, which I have none, but I'll use anything that I have to force the fluids back into my bladder, back into my bloodstream until my eyes turn yellow.
Ugh.
Rather than get up.
No, no way. I can't tolerate that. It's a miracle I made it through Blade Runner without having to go to the bathroom.
No, I heard it was good, though.
Yeah.
No? No good?
It looked great and it sounded great. I'm like...
Do you like the original Blade Runner?
I love that's like my favorite movie.
I heard Rutger Hauer is not in this one.
No, he's dead.
Oh, he's dead? Why'd he die?
Didn't you see the original Blade Runner?
No, in the movie he's dead. The Rutger Hauer's not dead.
Oh, I see. What, he was...
But he's a robot. What do you mean die? Can't they just make another one?
Yeah, I guess, but... And it becomes this whole, like, yeah, no, it's a whole thing.
So, I'll give you a couple things. I went to, when I went to China, I went to the Canton Fair. Canton Fair is the largest, you know, kind of trade fair for, yeah, stuff. And this one had, like, bicycles, toilets, kitchenware, power tools, and I was going to look for our current projects, actually, you know, and for our new projects with Booker and Dax, which obviously we're not announcing yet because they're new and we haven't done them yet. A lot of knockoff immersion circulators, like a lot of knockoff immersion circulators. I saw the one thing I kind of want, and then I was like, why do I want this? This is stupid. Okay, you know how they have waffle makers? Okay, imagine a Bundt cake maker, a full-sized Bundt cake maker that sits on your counter and flips over so it cooks, like, so you can get really light, airy. Pour it into the bottom part of the Bundt cake thing. It starts to cook. You flip it over, hits the bottom, and then puffs from both sides towards the center. It's actually not a bad idea because you can make, I'm sure, really light, airy Bundt cakes, and apparently you get fairly easy kind of release. But I was like, okay, when I make waffles, right? I make waffles when I'm doing waffles. I go in and out of waffles, between waffles and pancakes. Now, because I don't have gas in my house, it's waffles, right? But I'll make, like, oh, I don't know, eight waffles twice a week, so 16 waffles a week for a year, right? So that's 16 times 50. Let's say I only do it 40 weeks. That's still, like, hundreds of waffles, right? So even for a year, a waffle iron makes sense. How many Bundt cakes are you going to make?
I don't know. You can make...
If you made one a week for a year, I think it'd be worth it. 52 Bundt cakes. Because remember, you have an oven. You have a Bundt cake pan. You could cook a Bundt cake pan in the oven. So it's the convenience and speed, plus you are giving your counter space up to this Bundt cake maker. I would have totally... All this kind of negative stuff, I would have totally bought one if they had it in 120, but it's only in 220. They don't make a 120 version of the Bundt cake maker. Another thing, a lot of smokeless, I'm putting in air quotes because nothing is smokeless, grilling with those kind of quartz lamps and then, like, weird things. So they had a lot of vertical rotisseries for small things like hot dogs, corn, and shrimp, vertical in glass cylinders. Saw a lot of that. Saw a lot of... what's the word I'm looking for? What's the word when you kill the bacteria on the surface of vegetables? What do you call that?
Disinfecting.
Yeah. For fresh veg. Yeah, with ozone. A lot of knockoff ozone things. A lot of knockoff blenders. A lot of knockoff, some knockoff vacuum machines. But who uses knockoff kitchen equipment? No one in the United States that I know of. There's no even venue for it. When you go on Amazon, you can't buy the knockoff.
Maybe it's on Alibaba.
But, you know, but in other words, they must be selling either to an Asian market that I don't know, or to a European market that I don't know, or they're making the actual name brands. But the problem is that there's like three or four or five different factories all making the same knockoff. Very weird, very strange kind of a situation.
Hey, you want to take another call?
Sure. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave. How Matt from Mystic.
Hey, what's up? I'm glad you finally got your spins all.
Got the Spinzol. It's a miracle.
Oh, thank you. Is it working for you?
Oh, yeah. Good. Fantastic.
Good.
My kid loves the clarified strawberry juice.
Nice. Well, that's delicious stuff, especially carbonated. I mean, it just tastes good. What are you going to do? So what do you got for me? What's the question?
I was actually calling in for the guy. There was a guy who called the last time he had a show who made the sourdough bread that wasn't getting enough lift.
Sure, yeah.
You can either do more folds.
Right.
Or you can just put like a tiny amount of commercial yeast in it.
So for those who don't know what we're talking about, the caller called in and said that the sourdough bread wasn't getting enough rise. He was using quite a bit, I think, of a relatively old sourdough. So when Matt's talking about folds, he's talking about times doubling the old starter before you use it as fresh, correct? That's what you mean?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good advice, I think. You know, so you want... I mean, if you want to go pure with no commercial yeast, obviously, if you go commercial yeast, you're reducing the starter load, and that's reducing the acidity. But I think it all goes down to the amount of flour that's, lost its ability to hold gas because it's either been eaten or it's too acidic, or some combination of it's been eaten and it's too acidic. You know what I mean? Don't you think?
Probably.
Yeah. Nice.
Yeah, I mean, if he's not a purist, if he, you know, if he's not like an absolute purist about using the Levand culture, then like 2 grams of yeast, like a point, like 0.2% by weight, sort of after the autolyze, should be fine.
Yeah. Hmm. Hey, do you have a copy of the Modernist Cuisine bread book yet?
No, that's out of my price range. I bought a Spinzall instead.
Oh, no, well, hey, thank you.
You know what? You can listen to the Modernist Breadcrumbs miniseries for free, though, on heritageradionetwork.org.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but
I'm all over that.
Are they busting out any recipes in that?
No, not yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, TBD.
I need to get my hands on a copy of that, on a set of that books. I'm actually interested in, because I know less about that than I knew about the subjects in the original Modernist Cuisine stuff. So I'm kind of, you know, this is, you know, weird to say, but I'm actually super interested to look at it. And then when I was at the museum, I only had like 5 seconds to look at it, and everyone else was, you know, had their grubby little paws over it, so I couldn't read it.
Did they give one in the museum?
No. No. Anyways. All right, Matt. You got any questions for us? You're just giving us.
No, that was it. I just wanted to weigh in for Dan from Seattle.
So. Oh, nice, super. All right. Well, anyway, keep us posted on stuff you have with the Spinzall. Maybe I'll see you next time I'm up in Mystic.
All right, sounds good.
All right, cool. That's what I did in China. I saw some cool holographic displays, but it's not cooking related, so I won't talk about it now.
Chat room wants to know what you ate there.
In China?
Yeah.
In China, I didn't have to have anything super spectacular in China that I've never had before. I'm going to give myself 30 seconds, not even 30 seconds.
Somebody wants to know if butt cakes was among the things you ate.
Butt cakes?
I don't know. I thought that was maybe reference to an old joke.
I don't know. Butt cakes. Butt cakes.
Checking the archives.
Check the archives for butt cakes. But I will say this. I will just put it this way. So when I went to the Philippines, I was in the Philippines for a day, and I was the guest of the Shangri-La Hotel in Manila, in the fort, and I did a master class there. And then afterwards, the guys from the curator bar in Manila took me out on the town late night, because I had a 5 a.m. flight. So, you know, basically we went around Manila until 2 and then got in a cab to go to the airport. And one of the things that they got me was balut. So I finally had balut.
What is it?
Balut is the Filipino egg that is the day before it hatches. They boil it and then you eat the chicken fetus. It's a well-known thing.
How was it?
So it was fine. I thought it tasted fine. I mean, what you do is you crack the top of the egg, you put salt in it, you suck out the juices. I have videos of it, but it's kind of horrifying for people. So my wife looked at it, and she's like, that's horrifying. Never show anyone that video ever again. So you suck out the juices, like, and then you break it open, and you have, there's this like weird calcified blob where all of the waste from the growing bird goes, that's hard, and you throw away that calcified blob and you eat the little chiclet ball thing that's left over. And I have to say, it tastes pretty good. It tastes like a mixture of chicken soup, egg, and like giblet stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so
what's worse, watching you eat that or watching you eat woodcock?
I know you love the word woodcock. Watching you eat woodcock. So watching me eat woodcock is much more horrific because the blood particles were hitting you in the face. I mean, the problem with the woodcock was you were getting hit in the face with the blood particles. The goopy, totally decayed because they had hung the woodcock until it was nice and stinky. High, as they put it in England. And then, spitting those... You know, as you break the bones or crunch the little, I could see it like, it's like you were at a dentist's office and like woodcock was flying out of my mouth and like hitting you in the face. It was nasty.
Maybe it's a good time to take a break.
Wait, let me finish the balut.
Okay.
So, for those of you out there who are interested in balut but don't want to taste it, like do it or taste it, the closest thing I can say, if you want to mimic the flavor of balut, is pressure cooked eggs. So if you do, you know, this my standard kind of pressure cooked egg, which is you take a regular egg, you put it in water, you bring it up to a simmer, you simmer it for a couple of minutes to set it, you put it in a, you know, close the lid on the pressure cooker, take it up to 15 PSI, which is second ring, or I don't know what that is in bar. It's like two, it's like 1,000 extra millibar, so, you know, 2,000 total. Depends on how you measure. Anyway, do that for an hour. Let the pressure come down naturally. And when you open it, the eggs will be brown. And the flavor of those eggs with salt is very, very similar to the flavor of balut. The only difference is that it's not going to be juicy, have that soupy thing. So if you serve that with a little bit of chicken stock, you will have almost a dead ringer for the flavor of balut. And by the way, for those of you that are wondering, do the feathers get stuck in your teeth? No. Are the bones incredibly crunchy? No. So, you know, you're looking at a fairly accurate flavor representation of what's going on should you try to do that. Should you try to do a less horrifying looking, easier to produce balut. Anyway, back in a minute with more cooking issues. Bob's Red Mill has been milling whole grains since 1978. When you mill whole grains, you get all three parts, the bran, the germ, and the endosperm. The bran, or the roughage, makes up about 14% of the whole grain. It's the outer skin of the edible kernel. It contains large amounts of B vitamins, some protein, trace minerals, phytochemicals, but most importantly, dietary fiber. Learn more at bobsredmill.com/podcast. All right. So, Nastasia, I have a problem in that we have so many old questions that I can't remember which ones we answered. I think we should send Dave, I'll send Dave, like, earlier rather than later, a list, and we'll see if we can get someone to figure out which ones I've answered so that I don't double answer the questions. Does that make sense?
Wait, do I have to do that? what am I supposed to do?
I mean, you're the one
do?
That listen, can search the archives. I can't search the archives.
I can't just, like, search by... I would have to sit down and listen to every show.
No. Is there someone who... There's got to be someone who knows.
No. You guys.
How am I going to know whether I've answered the question or not? I can't remember whether I ate breakfast in the morning. I can't remember anything. People ask me questions all the time. Dave, how can you not know what you're going to do tonight? I'm like, because that's tonight. Like, I might not be alive then.
You have a list of questions. Why don't you, like, check off which ones you've answered?
How am I going to do that on my phone? I don't have, like, a remarkable tablet. I should print the... What I should do is print the questions. And then if I printed the questions, I could check them off, and then we could circle the ones that we don't do.
So going backwards in technology is the solution to this problem? I don't think so.
Well, I mean, look who you're looking with.
You can put it in an Excel document.
Excel my butt. How am I going to sit there and check it off? Hey, easy for everyone else to say, you know, I'm the one that has to sit here on my phone and read these questions. You know what I mean?
You should have a contest for chat room or for the listeners. Like, you know, go back, dig back through the archives on your own time.
Yeah, but how? Yeah.
And then I don't know. Give them a shirt.
Okay.
Give them the shirt of their choice.
Well, the aforementioned Enemy of Quality shirt seems to be a hot item.
They can't have a Heritage Radio shirt if they want a Heritage.
Oh, sure. They can have one of those too.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Which one? The sleeveless? I can't wear sleeveless shirts. Who do you know that wears sleeveless shirts?
Well, we're in Bushwick, so.
That's true.
But Nastasia, what do you think? I like the weird one with like the regular show graphic on it. The weird like '80s pseudo '80s graphic. But Nastasia doesn't like the pseudo '80s graphic.
Because I don't get it.
What's to get? It's a pseudo '80s graphic. Mm-hmm. It's nothing to get. It's my problem. People.
Chatroom is saying that you can if you want to state the question and then they will respond whether or not it's been answered, but.
What is it? Just call and respond? Well, look, I'll try to remember which one. I'll try to remember. Or you know what? We can put them up. We could. That's it. We could put it up on the chat room. Is the chat room only exist when we're here?
No. Well, no. No.
So I'll tell you what.
They only exist when you're on the air, though.
I'll make you a deal, Dave. Here's what we'll do. Next week, at the beginning of the show, we'll post the questions, right? And then people can say which ones we've answered.
Sure. Sounds great.
All right? All right. So we'll deal with some new questions now. This way, I know I haven't answered them. But the interesting thing here is I don't actually have answers for them, so we can just talk about them. Alex from Toronto writes in, Dear Dave, Dave and Nastasia, I've been contemplating buying a half cow or pig and wondered if you had any suggestions for how to ask the book... how to ask the butcher to break the meat down. I'm hoping to get as little ground meat and sausage as possible, and as many large cuts of meat as possible. Traditional butchery is optimized for bone-in cuts and seemingly wastes a lot of meat that can be cooked deliciously in a circulator. Has anyone developed alternate ways of breaking down animals that avoid this waste? If so, any advice on how I could communicate this request to a butcher who is not familiar with it would be appreciated. Thanks, Alex. Well, I mean, one thing that I will say is that you can definitely do a lot of bone-in cuts in the circulator. So, you know, all traditional cuts of meat can be done in the circulator. But I think this is a really interesting question. I think this is the kind of question that we should perhaps, like, defer and re-ask, although I have no way to remember, when we're, because we're trying to set up, aren't we, Dave, our meat show, like meat curing, all that. I mean, and butchery goes a lot with that. What do you think?
What was the question?
So the question is, you know, I'd be interested if anyone in the chat room has experience with this, but they're trying to figure out a more efficient way to butcher an animal for sous vide cooking specifically.
But what show are you referring to?
Oh, we're going to do an episode with, you know, we're going to get Johnny Hunter and, you know, maybe someone else, and we're just going to do curing and perhaps butchering questions.
Oh, okay. I missed the pre-production meeting for that one.
He's spicy today.
I know, right? Right? It's because we're off a week. He's, you know.
Yeah, I'm saving them all up.
Saving them all the zingers, you know.
Ooh, look, there's pizza with greens.
Nastasia, they're not going to ever give you pizza with greens. They don't like us. They're never going to give us pizza with greens on it. Ever.
Do you have arugula in your pocket right now?
No.
We used to bring it in, yeah, and yeah. You know, we said this before. We used to think we could shame them into serving it to us by pulling
it
out of our pockets
greens,
and putting it.
It's cilantro. Weird.
Anyway, whatever. That's not what we're talking about. So, anyway, you can use the other thing is if you get traditional cuts that are bone in and you don't want to cook them on the bone, you can cut the bones off and roast them, and it's incredibly delicious. So, like, one really good way to do something like a rib roast is to get the ribeyes out, do the ribeyes low temp, and then just roast off the bones with the meat on them, cut them, and serve them as kind of gnawing bones, and it's quite good. Or you can low temp the bones and then flash fry them and then serve them, and likewise, they're incredibly good. So most of the traditional cuts of meat, if you maximize for traditional meat cutting, also have good applications low temp or sous vide. The exception would be, of course, the tenderloin, which I have cooked it low temp and it works really well, but you just have to make sure when you're doing low temp, you just don't cook it too long or it turns pasty. Remember those tests we did with the fillets and how pasty they got when you cooked them a long time? Were you there for that?
No.
They turned to like a, even though they're not overcooked, they turned like just paste.
Yuck.
Yuck.
Chat room does want to know if you can do a fish butchery / curing show. Maybe that could be part of the meat show.
Fish butchery. So we want to get some good.
We should have Dave Pasternak on.
Yeah?
Yeah.
On fish butchery?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you know, if you have contacts for him, you can get him in?
Yeah.
And can he do a family show?
I asked him once and he said, of course I can.
He can go more than 30 seconds without cursing?
That's what he said.
All right.
Speaking of family show, Jim Leahy's coming on later this afternoon.
Oh.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you think he'll make it through an entire show without dropping some F-bombs?
Absolutely not.
All right. This from Jeff, Dave, and Nastasia. In the past, I fat-washed gin with avocado oil, and when I put it back in the freezer, the oil rises to the top. The puck is removed, and a simple filtering gives me a workable spirit. But I am working on a fat-washed vodka using coconut oil. The coconut oil is unrefined organic coconut oil. I'm having a difficult time getting it to separate out, which is weird because coconut fat, anyway, is so solid. You know what I mean? It's strange. And coconut oil in, like, coconut milk floats to the top so readily and turns into a puck. It's weird that Jeff's having problems here, but I mean, maybe someone in the chat room has some theories on this. The first time I put it in the freezer, it came out like whipped cream. The second time, I used the refrigerator, but only a small quantity of oil rose to the top for easy removal, and I ended up putting it through a coffee filter, which is slow. The last time, I tried to just use it without the coffee filter, but tiny, oily solids. What do you think of that string of words?
I'm okay.
You're okay with tiny, oily solids? What if I put the word olestra? What if I put the word olestra in your mind, and so now you're thinking of the tiny oily solids after they've gone through your body undigested? Now, how does that work?
So fine.
Wow. All right, Nastasia, you know what? Nastasia is going into these classes that are trying to erase some of her
anger,
internal anger. But I think some of her internal anger is focused towards things like tree fungus.
Yep.
And you.
Spores.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, the vast majority of it is towards me.
Right.
And Mark. I mean, let's not forget, and Mark. The last time I tried to use without a coffee filter, but tiny, oily solids ended up sticking to the inside of the glass, and it was ugly. Until my bar gets a Spinzol, do you have any ideas for how to get the oil out of the vodka? Well,
you can use a separate...
Set funnel. Nastasia just gave the correct answer. Bing, bing, bing.
You think I don't listen?
Well, because you don't. But that's great. So the... I would try a separatory funnel. So here's – now, separatory funnels are rather cheap. But before you invest in a separatory funnel, please put some of your product in the freezer in something glass, right? So what I'm trying to figure out is are you having a tough time separating it because of the pouring, or are you having a tough time separating it because it's not coming out of the liquid at all? If it's not coming out of the liquid at all, that's a separate kind of an issue. But if it's just that you can't separate it, then if you have a separating funnel, the oily stuff will flow to the top and the other stuff will sink to the bottom. And you should be able to get a nice, clear product. And if it's not separating at all, then we're going to have to do some sort of – you're going to have to add some sort of filtering aid. The problem is filtering aids will, in fact, strip some flavor out of it. So – try to use the smallest amount possible of something like bentonite or even maybe gelatin, something that will get rid of, that will just, grip onto some of these small particles. Because it's unrefined coconut oil, it might have water left in it or other particles that aren't pure oil, and that's why it's not floating to the top, in which case you'll need to fundamentally do a clarifying step on it because the stuff is actually in solution. But the easiest way to get the oily part out, the actual oily part, is to use a separatory funnel. And a separatory funnel is interesting because it's got a little stopcock on the bottom that you rotate, and then you're removing the liquids from the bottom. And then you can swirl it to get the fats to rise up to the top, and you can let it sit in your freezer for as long as you want and rock and roll. But that's what I would try out. Right, Nastasia?
Yep.
Yeah, I can't believe it. Nastasia, listening.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah, crazy. And so this is from Ken. Let me see. It's a rather long question from Ken Ingberg. Long time no hear.
I know.
Yeah. As he says, long time no pester. I hope you and the crew are well. With my Thanksgiving coming up, I thought I would pose this question. When, if ever, does one use a covered roasting pan? There are plenty of fond recollections of Mom using that thin speckled graniteware covered roaster on the internet, but very little actual information about this. Let's first dismiss those who say don't use any roasting pan, mostly because the sides prevent good circulation. Sure, but sometimes you want more volume below the thing you are roasting. Carrying a hot, heavy turkey or other big roast may be dangerous on a baking sheet, and a roasting pan gives you the pan sauce option, especially if the pan is heavy enough for a cooktop. I will just interject here. I use roasting pans a lot. However, I don't. I always elevate my bird above the roasting pan to get that extra kind of. I always elevate it. Now, we'll be honest. I've never run the tests. Right? I've never tested elevated versus not elevated. So it's hard for me to say really what the difference is. But the underside of my birds are always blonder. Underside of my roasts are always blonder, which is why, I do the old, when I'm doing traditional cooks, I do the old school where I start it on the underside, cook it off high for a while, and then flip it over so that I get colored on the bottom. You know what I mean? Anyways. Back to the question. You might say that covering the roasting pan is steaming, not roasting. Okay, so what are the pros and cons of steaming, maybe with uncovering for the last half hour or so? You see discussion points about how covered cooking makes meat moister or retains moisture. Is that true? No. It will. It depends. I'll answer all these questions at once instead of going. To me, moistness is more of a function of the moisture retained on a muscular level, which is in turn a function of time and temperature rather than covering. Think how overcooked pot roast can be swimming in liquid, but the meat tastes dry and pasty. Search Stew Science on Serious Eat for Kenji's related investigation on this issue. By the way, as an aside, Kenji, interesting thing he posted, I saw on clarifying old oil with gelatin to filter it as a fast way to get your fry oil back in. I'll have to run some tests on that because...
The whole thing of fry oil?
So, well, I mean, he's not using a 35 or 50-pound deep fryer. He's, like, you know, cooking in a pot of oil. And so what you do is at the end of the night, you leave it in the pot, you stir in a gelatin mix, it settles out into a puck the next day, and then you have the and then you have clear oil. It's actually an interesting idea. The idea, what I would want to test, and I haven't had any time because I just read this today, but you know, the oil breakdown is for a number of things. There's particles in it, right, that lend to off flavors, but the actual you get free fatty acids. A little bit of free fatty acids in oil is good because it makes the oil more polar. So it means that you can actually get better heat contact from the oil into the food, which is why hyperfresh oil doesn't work. But excess fatty acids have those awful rancid flavors, and oil starts to go rancid. So what I want to know is can this gelatin trick actually suck some of that crap out of the oil and make it as though it is fresher? Not just that it has less crap in it, but is the oil itself actually fresher? I don't know.
Got to wrap up in a minute.
Anyway, so broadly speaking, this is back to Ken. I would like to say steam trapped in the covered roaster cooks the meat faster. But you get very little Maillard browning until you uncover the roaster. I'm hoping you confirm or correct me or shed some entertaining nuance on the subject. One other point, I have not yet tried it, but does manipulating a covered roaster and the associated steam make for better bread? Best regards, Ken. Okay, so really, really quickly on this and my thoughts on this. Obviously, cooking bread, this all goes back to, this is the miracle of moisture management. We are dealing with the miracle of moisture management problem right here. If you go back in the 50s, people used to make turkey ovens that were essentially covered roasters where it roasted and the entire bird roasted in the in this contained thing, which is not much bigger than those big old enamelware turkey roasters. And they did brown. And the issue with it is covering a pot does one thing and one thing only. It increases the humidity. It reduces evaporative cooling, right? So anytime you cover a pot with something with liquid in it, you are decreasing the ability of liquids to flash off. You're increasing the humidity. You're decreasing the amount of temperature drop you can get via evaporative cooling. And so you're increasing the temperature. Now, it is true that when you have a lot of moisture on the surface of a product, or if you have a lot of moisture, let's say, bubbling out of a bunch of juices below it. So if you have a turkey sitting in a pot with a lot of juice underneath and the juice hasn't solidified or caramelized yet, right, then that juice is going to keep bubbling. As that keeps bubbling, it's going to keep the temperature basically keep it at 212 at the surface, and it's going to be harder to brown it because you have to overdrive the temperature to get the surface of the meat above the temperature of boiling water, which you need to do. You need to evaporate some of the liquid off the surface, dry off the surface. Once the surface is dry, whether it's in a pot or whether it's in anything else, it's going to start browning. So in bread, you get the initial higher temperature and the rise, and then presumably the surface of the bread, enough moisture leaves the pot such that it can start browning, right? And that's how Leahy does his
pot bread.
Pot bread. Thank you. In a cookware situation, all you're doing by covering the thing is increasing the temperature at which it's cooking, and whether or not it browns is going to depend on whether there's excess moisture left, whether the surface of the meat can be driven fast enough to get the temperature higher. Dave's not going to let me go long enough into this. Well, anyway, we could try to. If you have more questions on this, I can get back into it. We could talk more about roasting pan technologies because it's getting close to Thanksgiving anyway, and I'm going to talk about how I'm going to do my turkey again this year. We'll get back more with roasting next week, and we'll catch the other questions next week on Cooking Issues.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awali, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.